Whenever through the years, Swami Kriyananda, the founder of Ananda, a dedicated disciple of Paramahansa Yogananda, whenever he's been asked the question by anyone, do I need a guru? Swami's answer has always been, not if you don't think you do. Meaning, it depends on what you want from life. He said, if you want self-realization, if you want to extricate yourself ultimately from all the confining boundaries of wrong identification with limitation rather than embracing the infinity, if that's not what you're looking for, then you can just go on your own. But at the point at which we ask for that kind of freedom, it is simply and literally impossible to obtain it without help. It's really not a point to argue about or dispute at all or even make the slightest effort to persuade. It's very interesting through the years discussing these matters with people, as I have done for many decades. You know, there's a kind of question you get, and the kind of question is from a person who's really trying to embrace a higher understanding, but simply needs to have their questions answered, to have their intellect satisfied. I certainly was that kind of devotee myself. I just was not inclined to take anybody's word for anything, even Yogananda's word. I remember the first time I read the statement, he said, environment is stronger than willpower. That was the statement he made. I remember vividly my inner response, not stronger than my willpower. That's what I thought. And it was many, many, many years before the truth of that statement really began to penetrate into my consciousness. And then, not reluctantly, but with a little bit of surprise, I said, he really knew what he was talking about. Of course, a few of those experiences cause you to be a little more humble on the front side of the equation too, if you're really listening. But the difficulty, and nowadays especially, is that people have made how they feel, how we feel, the criteria for our decision-making in life. In Kali Yuga, which is the age of form and matter, which we're just recently coming out of, everything was just fixed. I was speaking to Nirmoha recently, who had a long career in the Midwest as a Lutheran pastor, and we were discussing the difference of that life versus this life, and he said, there, you were born into your religion, and it was a really big deal if you changed. We've all heard Garrison Keillor, so we know about the Lutherans and the Catholics in Minnesota. And so he found himself in a position, as he put it very simply, of having to minister to everybody, whether they wanted to be there or not, which was a completely different sort of way of living. You were a Lutheran, you were a Methodist, you were a Presbyterian. You came to a new city and you looked for your Presbyterian church. And that's how you called yourself. You didn't even say, I belong to this church. You just said, I am a. And you were born into it and generally died in it, sometimes long before your body passed away. But all of that is disintegrated now, just completely disintegrated. I mean, start with religion. Traditional pastors lament the lack of denominational loyalty. But people like us, who of course are reaping the crop of that lack of loyalty, are very glad now that people are making experience their criteria. Even years ago in the 60s, when we were at Ananda Village and the, you know, great, what I look back on now is disintegration of morality, but at the time I called it the sexual revolution, was starting. And Swami Kriyananda, who represents a very traditional, very orthodox path and is himself a monk, people ask him, well, what do you think, you know, about this total breakdown of all traditional standards? And to everyone's surprise and temporary delight, he said, I think it's a good idea. That was a very happy thing to have heard. He said, because people are making experience the criteria of what they believe is true. He said, but in order for that really to work, people have to be honest to their experience. And they can't merely conduct an experiment in which they have predetermined the result and pay no attention to the evidence as it comes. Because there are divine laws, human laws, religious laws, everything like that is just made afterwards. Divine laws are not a matter of voting into existence or convenience or social custom or stability of society. I mean, there's a lot of other things that are called laws that are all for those reasons. Divine laws are the way that we're made. And we see them around us all the time and don't question them because they're self-evident. If you don't eat, unless you happen to be a God-realized master who can energize his body directly from the air. But as a rule, if you don't eat, you will die. If you eat nothing but cake, you will probably get sick. If you walk and you go into a stream and you weight yourself down with stones and go under the water, you will not have any air and you will die. If you put your hand into a flame, it will burn. And we don't go around sort of thinking, I am a free person, I make my own decisions, nobody tells me what to do, the candle will not burn me, boom, like that. There are techniques, yes, for transcending the material plane, but they're not based on ego assertion. Now, this is an orderly universe. Everywhere we look, it's orderly. Why would it not be orderly in terms of our own inner consciousness as well? What presumption, merely because it's not self-evident to us, to simply declare that it's self-declared? People from time to time try to just create whole new ways of living. But if we're honest to our experience, sooner or later we discover. Now it's become folk wisdom, like what goes around comes around, which is another way of speaking of a very subtle principle of karmic law. If you're loving and kind to people, you have a better chance of having good friends. If you're mean and self-centered, chances are pretty good you're going to end your life all by yourself. If you demean and disrespect people around you, people are not going to want to be around you. This is just the way it works, isn't it? Now, once we set ourselves to even more subtle goals, which is, I would like to transcend ego. I would like to be absolutely fearless. I would like to look at this world and see behind it the power and the presence of God. We are moving into territories that ordinary human consciousness has the capacity to imagine and to long for, but can't necessarily just figure out. And the problem is, as Swamiji has described it and is often described, the very tool that we're trying to use to extricate ourselves, which is our mind and our own way of thinking, is really the problem. You just can't get out of a problem with the problem. That's the way it works. The human ego decides, it has the capacity to decide, let me phrase it differently, the human being has sufficient self-awareness to be able to cognize in an objective, impersonal way its own suffering. This is what sets human beings apart. Most animals, unless they're human beings who have sort of gone down lowly to that level for a short time and are coming back, but the majority of animals, they don't really suffer to the same extent even that human beings do, because they don't have the ego refinement to be able to consider themselves objectively. A dog isn't usually sad because he's aware of the fact that in India, many of his species are out on the street and don't have enough to eat. It's not like a thought form that he can rise to. The dog may be unhappy if he doesn't have enough to eat. He may be even unhappy if his owner is sad that day. But he can't stand back and contemplate the greater reality of dogdom and as it exists in the world. But we as human beings, we can literally feel the pain of someone on the other side of the world just by imagining what they might be going through. And so it is, we can see ourselves in the same way. We can recognize where we are today, the great experience we had a few days ago, the happiness we had as a child as compared to what we have now, the happiness we perceive in somebody in front of us and our longing for that. And all of that is the beneficial aspect of ego that says, I want to do something about this. I sense a greater reality than what I am experiencing. I feel confined. Looking back on my own early search for truth during my childhood, before I had the words for it, I finally came to the word confinement. I felt hopelessly, helplessly confined in my own limited perception. There was an intuition that told me that there was more, but I couldn't break through into it with the tools that I had. Now, what happens to us is that there has to be a point it's a very odd balancing point between willpower and humility. And often on the spiritual path, this is a very important dividing line. We need enough willpower, creativity, independence to decide that we're going to follow a different path. We're not going to stay where we were born. We're not going to go with the culture that's around us. We're going to magnetize to ourselves and seek out this more unusual path. It takes great creativity and courage even to imagine that self-realization is possible, that life isn't just a matter of following along the course that everyone else follows, and I have my job and my family, and then I gradually grow old, and then I die. You know? At some point, something else comes in, and it takes a certain amount of willpower to extricate ourselves from the environment, which is stronger than our willpower, which is pulling us down into this other thought form. Doesn't that happen to all of us? We walk out of this temple, and it's so crystal clear when you walk in here. Then you go to the office tomorrow, and all of a sudden, it's a little bit harder to remember. You know, and then by Wednesday, it's really beginning to slip. Right? We tried very hard for years to have a Wednesday night service, figuring that Wednesday was the critical point. But in fact, by Wednesday, people had forgotten why they wanted to come, and they didn't recover again until Saturday, so we had to give it up. All right? But then we try to apply. Then we become, as I was just trying to say, we become persuaded. We don't remember anymore. Oh, I know where I was going with this. The more difficult issue about it, and this is how I was starting to say how Swami described it, commonly described, the mind is a labyrinth. And a labyrinth is a very interesting concept, because a labyrinth or a maze, you walk into it. There was some place, some city that I was in, where they had a maze that was made out of hedges, and the hedges were higher than your head, and it was a little scary once I got caught up in that thing. You just wander and you think you've kept a good sense of direction. You think you know where you are. And this path looks really good. And you walk out and bang, you've hit just a wall. So you turn around and you carefully try to remember. And this is the point where I made the right turn. So I make, yes, now I have it. Then I go this way. And you're marching along and feeling like you're really making progress. Wham, you're right into the wall again. This becomes a little more confusing, doesn't it? So you much more carefully, with a whole different method, looking up this time instead of down, you do, but again and again and again and again. This is progress when all we're using is the perspective we have. Now, of course, what's going on beyond that is those of expanded awareness are standing, as it were, on step ladders, watching the maze, and they're chatting with each other, and they're watching you run like this. Years ago, when I lived at Ananda Village, one day I came to work, and there was a little tiny spider on my typewriter. That was before computers. He was on my typewriter. Little tiny spider, and he was a spunky little spider. And I'm just watching him, and he's racing across, you know, one end of the keyboard and then up to the platen, and he's standing up there, and you can see him surveying his whole kingdom, and then he spies something of interest, and he shoots down, and he runs over here, and then he's so proud again. And I was all by myself, and I was following him with my thumb like this, thinking, you think you're so powerful and you're so free, you have no idea, at any moment could be all over for you. Then there's this very eerie sense of the thumb that's hanging over me, you know. And I sort of see myself coming to work that morning, coming to my office, and just feeling so peppery and proud of myself. And the divine force is just saying, you think you're so much in control. You have no idea. Nobody can persuade you of that. I can entertain you by talking about it, but nobody can persuade anyone of that. You feel it in your heart. You feel it with anguishing truth that we're just helpless here. We mean well, we're good, we're not stupid, we're talented in many things that people value. But we really can't get out of this without those who know the way out. Isn't that obvious? And why would we resist that? You know, why would we not, with everything that's in us, run to the feet of those great ones, and not just sort of wait. Jesus himself can teach me, but no one else can. I would be a disciple of Yogananda, but I'm not going to listen to anyone else. You know, gradually we become so humble that just anybody who knows anything is what we want to hear. An autobiography of a yogi, the first sentence is, the characteristic feature of the Indian culture has always been the search for eternal verities and the concomitant, and everyone always says guru-disciple relationship, but that's not what it says. It says disciple-guru relationship. Because until we are willing to ask and receive, Guru can't do anything for us. So it really isn't a question of, do I have my Guru, where is my Guru? It's a question of, am I willing to recognize the limitations of my own self and to open myself to light, goodness, and wisdom wherever it may be given to me? Answer that question, yes. Look at the world with those eyes, and everywhere you turn, you'll find the walls of that maze dissolving and the infinite view opening out in front of you.